So Father Rupi went back, wrote the speech, and the Pope said, "And before you read it, let me see it." He went over the text. "Sister, I don't like to do this. Could you get a copy of my Christianity of the 20th Century, please? I feel like a heel." This is the speech given before the Second Vatican Council by our Holy Father, really, through the Jesuit General. "This new godless society," that's what he said. He said other things, but this is one thing that he said. "This new godless society operates in an extremely efficient manner, at least in its higher levels of leadership. It makes use of every possible means at its disposal, scientific, technical, social, or economic. It follows a perfectly mapped out strategy. It holds almost complete sway in international organizations, in financial circles, in the field of mass communications, press, cinema, radio, and television. It is like the City of Man of St. Augustine, and it not only carries on the struggle against the City of God from outside the walls, but even crosses the ramparts and enters the very territory of the City of God, insidiously influencing the minds of believers, including religious and priests, with its hidden poison, producing inevitable fruits in the church, naturalism, distrust, and rebellion." Within 24 hours of giving this speech, all the press, with no exception, I'm told, all the news agencies in the world, every radio and television network in the world, blasted the Jesuit General for saying this. "We're exposing the fact that it's internationally organized to destroy the faith of Christianity." So, this Pope, as we all know, is extraordinarily popular. And the media know it. They want to weaken and, if possible, destroy his influence.
That was the only statement we heard. You know, he just spoke fast and quoted and...
It is.
There was no explanation, nothing.
You may have heard about Marshall McLuhan. The name, you may have heard the name. Marshall McLuhan is, I would say, the outstanding philosopher of mass communications in the world, a Canadian convert. The priest who received him into the church was my confessor in Canada when I taught there at the university. This priest showed me a letter he received from Marshall McLuhan on one occasion. The last sentence of the letter I've never forgotten. "This McLuhan, than whom nobody knows the press and the media better." This is McLuhan's statement. The media are engaged in a Luciferian conspiracy against the truth. The media are engaged in a Luciferian conspiracy against the truth. That's a very large statement. So before we leave this virtue of chastity or virginity in Our Lady, we better make sure we know who is our enemy. I consider it psychologically impossible to remain chaste for a religious, no matter how well intentioned, who is not very, very cautious in what they read. And that means that those who are training them cannot stupidly tell themselves, well, he or she is an adult. Nobody is an adult in competition with the devil, because the devil knows human nature, and unless we protect ourselves, he is smarter than we. And this began with the statement, especially of Pius XII, at the canonization of Maria Goretti, that the single virtue which most needs to be protected in the modern world is chastity. Because once chastity goes, everything goes. If you don't mind, let me tell you another story. The subject, I think, deserves it. Among my close friends that I came to know well during my studies in Rome, my graduate studies in theology, was a Jesuit from Poland, by that time a priest, who had been a scholastic during the Second World War and was a prisoner of the Nazis in a concentration camp. As far as he knows, he is the only religious who survived Dachau. He was there 4.5 years. His job was to act as interpreter. He spoke several languages, which is one reason why his life was spared. But his physical work was carting the bodies of persons who've been gassed to death to the furnaces where the bodies would be burnt. But not before all the bodies were scalped and the hair was removed and mounds 50 and more feet high of human scalps so the hair could be used for mattresses. Well, stories that you could not tell, they are too terrifying. He learned English by telling me, it was not his intention, stories from Dachau, walking the streets of Rome. But he said, we had many professional people, prisoners, in fact, some of the most prominent prisoners were professionals, psychiatrists, doctors, priests, and so on. We saw this cruelty day after day, the most demonic hatred of other human beings, inoculating people with dread disease just to watch them die. So we would talk far into the night. We were too hungry to fall asleep. How is it that human beings could become so vicious? I've told this to many audiences. We concluded. First we speculated, then we investigated, and then we found out. Listen to this. Every one of those cruel guards and executioners in Dachau was a sex pervert. In other words, once the virtue of chastity goes, everything goes. There is no crime of which a person is incapable. if that person has lost his or her chastity. Just as conversely, a person who lives a life of chastity is capable of the highest virtue. Let me briefly, number one, faith. The source for that, the gospel source for that is Luke 1:45. Second, virginity. The gospel source for that is Luke 1:34. Third, resignation. Synthesized in the word fiat. Especially, and of course the term occurs in Luke 1:38. Humility is the fourth. The whole Magnificat is a hymn of humility. It occurs in Luke chapter 1, verses 46 through 55. What Our Lady's humility shows, and therefore becomes for us imitable, is humility as a virtue of religion and humility as a moral virtue. Humility as the virtue of religion is related to God. The essence of humility as the virtue of religion is the recognition of God's infinity, of His allness, of His greatness. I believe this needs stressing, and the earlier in the religious life, the better. That the essence of humility is not as a moral virtue in our relationship to other people. It is first and primarily a recognition of God's ownness, His greatness, and then by contrast, of my littleness, in fact, my nothingness. The very word Magnificat is an expression of humility as the virtue of religion. Magnifying God is the essence of humility. Minimizing self is only a correlative, a consequence of magnifying God. And I think many people can cultivate a humility which is no doubt good in itself, with almost no relationship to God. Don't you think so?
No.
And yet that is its essence. So then, as a virtue of religion, Our Lady, the whole Magnificat, tells us it is a recognition of God's greatness. The hymn that I like, and I'm sure you do too, "How great thou art, O Lord, how great thou art." And after you finish that, you hardly have to say, "And how little am I." It follows. But then, secondly, humility as a moral virtue is the relationship of the individual to others. That I do not, as we say, pride myself on what I have that maybe someone else doesn't. Then you have to go back to humility as a virtue of religion. Why should we not pride ourselves on what we've got that others don't have? Because whatever I have is from God. It's not mine. In strict honesty, I should never say what I have, because though I may say I have it, but I must add, only because I received it. In training others, I believe the hardest part, and this is after 30 years in the priesthood, the hardest part is for people to recognize that God is total and complete master. I was putting my cassock on this morning, and the hook inside my cassock got caught in some thread inside the cassock. And I'm analytic enough to figure it out. And I was getting impatient. Lord, keep me sane. There are laws, whatever the physical laws involved, they're your laws. When the hook gets caught in thread, I'm sure a physicist could write a book about it. God is master of everything. It is recognizing His ownness and my nothingness. The essence of humility, therefore, the essence is recognizing who God is. And then I will also, logically, sanely, recognize who I am, and that is not much. Recollection. We don't usually think of recollection as a virtue, but it is. Recollection is the virtue of prayer practiced throughout the day. I think the classic text for that is Luke chapter 2, verse 19. Remember after the visit of the shepherds, all they had seen, they marveled, and then Our Lady is said to have kept all these things in her heart. Recollection is uniting everything with God. The secret there in training others, and of course in training ourselves, is to get into the habit of never performing a single human act without uniting it with a moment's prayer. I have a set of two lectures on aspirations in prayer. We may say something about this. Am I supposed to give some sort of a on prayer? Well, we'll talk more about that then. All I know is that if we can tie in every single human action, which means every act we perform consciously and deliberately. Now, some people perform a lot of these. Some, I'm almost tempted to say, perform none of these. Some people do almost nothing, it seems, consciously and deliberately. Others, however, have the habit of almost a constant deliberation, regardless. Depending on our psyche and our intellectual habits in this matter, to never perform a single act where I've used my free will, which thereby becomes a moral act, and, assuming we're in the state of grace, becomes a meritorious act. Every conscious, deliberate act is a moral act. Every moral act for a person in the state of grace is a meritorious act. The secret is never to perform any such, maybe 10 times, or if you are so minded, 100 times a day, without a moment's, at least a moment's prayer. And don't tell me you're wasting time. Because if we have enough time to reflect on what I'm doing, otherwise I wouldn't be performing a conscious act. If I have enough time to think of a creature, why shouldn't I have enough time to think of the Creator? I think the important word in that statement of Luke, Mary kept all these things in her heart, is the word all. We may be sure that Our Lady was never out of union with God. Some people, very few, begin that way early. For most of us, it's a matter of training. And at first it may be quite mechanical, just using aspirations, ejaculations, having favorite ones that each person has, and having favorite ones for certain occasions. But to have something definite on the mind beforehand, so that when the situation arises, that I will immediately, for a moment, unite myself with God. I pick up the telephone, an aspiration. I open the door, an aspiration. I walk into my room, an aspiration. I walk out of my room, an aspiration. The subway is crowded. I can't get in. They shove, physically push the people. Big bodies, I've seen them. You can't even look. They shove them into the subway. Clearly, I don't want to get in. Into that, shall I say, cattle car, I make an aspiration. Or I'm crowded, I can only stand on one leg, it's so crowded in the subway. I make aspirations. In any case, Our Lady is a great model. Sixth, trust in God. Our Lady's trust in God is something which is revealed to us in every occasion when she appears in the Gospels. At Nazareth, at the Annunciation. At Nazareth again, at the time when Mary discovered that she was with child. In the journey to Bethlehem. In Bethlehem itself. At the presentation, when Simeon told her that a sword would pierce her heart, to Egypt. Talk about trust in God. She saw the wine ran out at Cana, and she told her son, and he seemed to rebuke her. Any ordinary mother would have said, well, I guess he doesn't want to do what I'm asking him to do. I'm asking him to work a miracle. So what does she do? As only a mother would have the nerve to do it. She left him, went over to the servants and told them, do whatever he tells you. And I'm sure he overheard her. Oh, no, mother. Oh, yes, son. All right? You read the lives of the saints. Trusting God in impossible situations. And that's Mary. Remember, it was to her that were said those words. Nothing is impossible to God. Remember? No one else had a right to hear those, because no one else had that kind of trust. And that's what trust is. Trusting means hoping in God's goodness against all human expectation. And we know that God rewards it. I think many people would enter religious life if they had more trust. I think more people would remain and persevere in religious life if they had more trust. They are frightened by the prospect of not a lifetime of this, and they conjure up all sorts of impossible situations, not realizing that God's grace will be available. That's our lesson.
This concludes part one of Father John Harden's class on Imitating the Virtues of Our Lady. Part two is found on the following tape.